everyone, and thank you again for listening to Exposing Mold, the podcast, where I, Keely Severson, Eric Johnson, and Alicia Swamy discuss the latest information related to toxic mold, our progress in trying to get the 1988 Holmes definition of chronic fatigue recognized, and novel theories surrounding toxic mold exposure. Last episode, we left off explaining that there was a mystery outbreak in Lake Tahoe, and the CDC originally came to investigate because they thought that Epstein-Barr virus was the primary culprit. Gary Holmes of the CDC requested Dr. Cheney to examine healthy patients and controls. And this is when we found that even healthy patients were presenting with reactivated EBV. Eric, what did this do to the working definition or the theory that they had come up with at this time in regards to what the primary cause of the illness was?
Well, the Center for Disease Control had a provisional theory that the Epstein-Barr virus might have mutated. It had achieved some kind of new pathogenesis that even changed sufficiently to move into creating an epidemic cluster-style illness. Theoretically, if the Epstein-Barr virus got new protein spikes, new receptors, that could make it more contagious, easier to transmit than simply saliva. So there almost seemed to be a basis for suspecting that. But the problem with the Lake Tahoe outbreak was that it was a wildfire outbreak transmissible illness that went from person to person with a 4 to 7 day incubation period. Well, even if the Epstein-Barr virus had mutated so that it was easier to catch, that still wouldn't account for the quick transmission. So there were some discrepancies between the Center for Disease Control's working hypothesis and what was being reported from Lake Tahoe, where people were suddenly lighting up with all the signs and symptoms and the parameters of the Epstein-Barr virus, but the incubation period still didn't agree. So the Center for Disease Control sent two epidemiologists, Gary Holmes and John Kaplan, out to look at the serologies to see if they could reconcile this matter. And thanks to Dr. Gary Holmes asking Dr. Cheney to run some titers on healthy controls, they found that people with no signs or symptoms at all appeared to have the same immune defect. Up until that point, the idea of creating a syndrome definition for the Epstein-Barr virus was predicated on seeing everything that you would see in the kissing disease, the swollen lymph glands, the elevated titers, the fatigue, the headaches. But if you've got healthy controls that have that same immune defect, you can't write a syndrome definition for people that have no symptoms. So the goalposts kind of changed at that point. The CDC began to become aware that there was something larger going on by creating a description, which Dr. Gary Holmes was calling a chronic mononucleosis-like syndrome, that it was like EBV, but it was not EBV. And it was something that you had to look for, not just in the sick people, but in healthy controls as well. Now, Dr. Charles Lapp in South Carolina was seeing an outbreak in a symphony orchestra at the same time. And he managed to acquire the same Epstein-Barr serology test. And he applied this test to other members of the symphony orchestra who weren't sick, and even to some family members and people who were in close contact with the sick members of the symphony orchestra. And he found the same thing, that people who had no signs or symptoms had this same aberrant EBV profile. So the investigation changed course at that point. It went from blaming EBV as the prime mover to the suspicion that perhaps there was something else, an Agent X, an activator virus, something unknown that was unleashing the Epstein-Barr virus. So that's where the confusion got started, because when the Center for Disease Control abandoned their EBV hypothesis and created a new syndrome, it was vague, and nonspecific, and they didn't really make it clear that what they were looking for was not the presence of the Epstein-Barr virus itself, but for a subliminal hidden immune defect that was causing it to be reactivated.
So they didn't make that clear when writing the definition?
Correct. Dr. Steven Strauss, one of the authors of the two 1985 papers on EBV, was trying to keep the Epstein-Barr virus theory in play because then he would be in control of it. He would get the funding. He could pursue whatever investigation that he wanted to. So even as the Epstein-Barr virus hypothesis was falling apart, Dr. Steven Strauss was still right in there saying, well, we know it's important because this is what doctors are detecting. If you go in with some kind of sickness, this is what they're going to find you, reactivated Epstein-Barr virus. So this is what we need to look into. And even if we find other viruses, such as HHV6 or cytomegalovirus, we still need to keep Epstein-Barr virus as the primary symptom in the syndrome. Otherwise, it's going to be very confusing.
And it has been very confusing.
Yeah. If you read the ultimate outcome of the Holmes investigation, Dr. Holmes actually does make it kind of clear. The instructions for his 1988 chronic fatigue syndrome definition state that the goal of the definition is like an algorithm. It's to rule out everything that is in the literature which is known to cause something similar. You have to go through this lengthy process, this long list of things that you need to rule out. And if you manage to get rid of everything that could be confused with this, whatever's left, you should look for abnormalities. If you find any abnormalities, to study them. Well, doctors completely misunderstood the Holmes definition, and they simply threw it at everybody who had fatigue and a headache, saying, well, we don't know what's causing it. They didn't go through the process of ruling it out, which at the time was fairly expensive, between $5,000 and $10,000 to rule out the known causes. And as the tests got more expensive and more conditions were found, eventually the cost to rule out everything went up to like $25,000. Dr. Peterson, one of the two doctors who initially called the CDC for help, said this has gone out of control. Who can afford to get a chronic fatigue syndrome diagnosis? It's impossible. It takes too long. It's too expensive. And even if you go through the whole process, who knows, there might be something else. It became unwieldy at that point. And the repeated requests of the Center for Disease Control to clarify their position, to state that they were looking for some subliminal immune defect, fell on deaf ears. So the confusion remains to this day.
So they purposely wrote it confusing to not point to lowered immunity. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think Dr. Holmes was a good guy. I mean, if you look at what he was trying to accomplish, he said this is the clearest path to finding something unknown. Rule out everything that's known, and if you find anything left over, look into it. Probably if he had just said that, rather than providing a long list of everything to rule out, it would have been clearer to doctors. But the way they treated the definition, it became a new name for everything that causes fatigue. And that was not the intention. It was a rational basis to start the investigation for whatever was going on. And somehow doctors didn't get the message and they didn't carry it on to that next step.
Do you think it wasn't carried on because the word got out that the cost of trying to look for it or trying to figure out the root cause would be too high, so they just didn't bother?
Partly. And also it was because Dr. Steven Strauss, even after the new definition, the Holmes definition was published, he did an unusual thing. He tried to take back control and get the concepts, get the theories involved, steered back over to what his theories were. If you look at the long-term effects of chronic active Epstein-Barr virus in other countries, it results in about a 50% mortality rate from cancer, generally Burkitt's lymphoma or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But there are other cancers that seem to be reactivated as well. Some really rare cancers that people have never seen. So Dr. Strauss's idea is if you stick with the Epstein-Barr virus syndrome theory, if that becomes the prime cause, doctors will see these cancers and they will become alarmed. It will get more attention to the whatever the widespread phenomenon is, and that would be his path. So what he did is, instead of using the Holmes method of ruling out everything and looking for abnormalities, he kept publicizing the Epstein-Barr virus. He acted like the chronic fatigue syndrome was, for all things fatigue, nonspecific, not worth pursuing. And if you had chronic fatigue syndrome, you very likely had a mental problem. That was his method for getting it out of his way so that he could carry on with what he wanted to do. So he actually worked kind of hard on perpetuating confusion. Maybe it was because he had a greater good in mind. Maybe he was a sort of a bad good guy. But the net result of his confusion spreading was that people did accept the chronic fatigue syndrome was vague, nonspecific, and meant to represent all things fatigue.
Can you discuss who Dr. Strauss was at this time?
He was a highly placed official in the National Institute of Health who was on the board for granting funding for all the research projects that people want to apply to get pursued. So even though he theoretically didn't have much power over the Center for Disease Control, as the guy in charge of the checkbook, He was somebody to be listened to, because if you didn't adhere to his philosophy and his theories, you weren't going to get any money.
And you think because of his ranking and his level of seniority in the NIH, that skewed everything for chronic fatigue syndrome?
Yeah, the three physicians who were familiar with myalgic encephalomyelitis in the who were present at the meeting for the Holmes Committee, which decided to create the chronic fatigue syndrome, they went in there hoping that they would not create a new name. They would simply call the Tahoe outbreak myalgic encephalomyelitis and add the investigative powers of the Center for Disease Control to their efforts, to the long history of ME. But Strauss was so determined to keep Epstein-Barr virus in play that they had a bitter argument. The three ME-literate physicians walked out. Doctors Byron Hyde, Gordon Parrish, and Alexis Shelikov. They were so frustrated that they walked out in protest, and this kind of left Dr. Strauss to take control, to do whatever he wanted to. And Dr. Hyde has written repeatedly over the years that Dr. Strauss controlled the flow of investigation from that point on by denying grant funding to anybody who wasn't looking into what he wanted to have studied. Yeah, this power shift, this power struggle, factionalism in the Center for Disease Control directly affected whether anybody got funding, how chronic fatigue syndrome was treated from that point on.
How did ME get lumped into chronic fatigue syndrome?
After the Holmes definition was published, Dr. Hyde started a very vocal campaign to say that chronic fatigue syndrome was a new name for myalgic encephalomyelitis, that the Holmes Committee had essentially simply slapped this horrible name onto a typical outbreak of ME and hoped to steer the investigation back into looking at the pre-existing ME, because the British had been looking into this for years, had a lot of history, a lot of evidence, and by connecting chronic fatigue syndrome with ME, they could get back on track and find out what the relationship was. In fact, the doctor from the CDC who convened the Holmes Committee, Dr. Carlos Lopez, who was head of the CDC's herpes virus and viral exanthems division, he announced the intention of the new syndrome was to find out what relationship it had to ME. He stated this at the ending of the meeting. Well, over time, people got confused by this, and they thought that chronic fatigue syndrome was the new name for ME, that the British and Canadian entity of myalgic encephalomyelitis had been renamed chronic fatigue syndrome. And they repeated this so often that people accepted that this was fact, like this had been done. The Center for Disease Control had no authority to do so. Without any formal study, without an assessment of the history and evidence of ME, they couldn't rename it. That's not scientific. But what they did is they applied this chronic fatigue syndrome name as a new standalone entity to what Hyde thought was a typical outbreak of ME. And the simple repetition over the years of saying, well, CFS is the same thing as ME, or it's a new name for ME, they accepted it without due process.
And this must be the backstory as to why, when we see grant funding announcements for ME/CFS, it's always those two illness names together.
Yeah, for many years, the Center for Disease Control resisted the idea of connecting the two. They understand science. They know you can't do it that way. But people completely forgot that chronic fatigue syndrome was not a new name for ME. And when the patient community kept insisting that it was, I believe that they felt it was an opportunity to kill two birds with one stone. They already had enough confusion about chronic fatigue syndrome, where the medical profession thought it was little more than fatigue. Why not get ME out of the way at the same time? Now, I'm pretty sure this is true because they know science. A scientist, when confused, goes back to the source. They find out whatever the evidence was that was named ME, whatever evidence caused the creation of the chronic fatigue syndrome, and they would compare the two. The fact that they blatantly ignore the customary methods of science and treat ME/CFS as if it was a new name for post-exertion malaise suggests to me that they are interested in bypassing the scientific method.
And creating further confusion, right? Because what I'm starting to see within the patient community is that there's these people that believe in chronic fatigue syndrome, there's people that believe in ME, and they're feuding against a definition. Now, I want to know how you feel about definitions in the medical community.
Any definition is fine. You can think up the stupidest name, the worst definition, as long as you remember to go back and look at the original animal. It doesn't really matter. You could call it anything. You could call it Agent X. You could call it, I think Hillary Johnson at one point said, clown with big shoe syndrome. To a scientist, the name on the package doesn't matter. It's what's in the box. Don't judge a book by its cover. See what's in the book. Everybody who made it through high school science knows this. So if you want to find out what the name represents, you simply go back and look at what the name was given to. How is it that every researcher on Earth somehow forgot this basic method? So I have no problem with the chronic fatigue syndrome definition or Ramsey's ME definition or any definition, just so long as you go back and look at what that name was applied to.
I wanted to circle back to a conversation that we had before, and I just remember you telling Keely and I that the whole idea of creating definitions is a farce. Yeah, you can't use a definition to define an illness. Could you speak more on that?
Sure. Every new name is essentially a power trip. It's an attempt to take over control. It means that whoever gave that name to something before has been shoved out of the way, and now the person with the new name, they're in control. And in science, you tend to assume that this is done for good reasons, that if somebody comes up with a new finding that improves the science or progresses it in some way, that they have good and honest intentions, and they're trying to make progress by creating a new name. But this isn't always the case. If somebody wants to get a scientific competitor out of the way, or remove some evidence that conflicts with their theory, all they have to do is create a new name and say, this is the new standard. This is the new data set. In terms of chronic fatigue syndrome, it's such a bad name and such a poor definition that getting rid of the name sounds like a terrific idea. But if you go back and look at the evidence that this name was based on, well, it removes some very interesting evidence. And in particular, the evidence of toxic mold at ground zero for the syndrome. All that disappears. If you create a new definition that says, well, we're going to look at the opinions of Fukuda or Strauss or some other doctors, well, they don't know about this evidence, or they never mentioned it. So all that evidence disappears. And interestingly enough, there was an outbreak of illness in Sacramento in 1975 that was investigated by a Dr. Eric Rill, an infectious disease specialist who was highly placed at the Mercy San Juan Hospital. And he investigated this outbreak and concluded that it was either a virus or a mycoplasma or a fungus. He didn't know what, but those were his top three candidates. He gave a provisional name of infectious venulitis to the 1975 Mercy Hospital outbreak, but this was quickly changed to the Mercy San Juan syndrome, or just the Mercy syndrome. And Dr. Rill tried for many years to validate his illness. He had a lot of evidence backing up his assertions. I mean, he's a very skilled, very competent doctor. And in 1984, he learned about myalgic encephalomyelitis and actually tried to change the name of his syndrome, the Mercy San Juan syndrome, to ME. And he had just about succeeded. He got the attention of ME specialists from New Zealand and England and was preparing to transition his name into ME when the Lake Tahoe outbreak happened. And all of a sudden, his efforts were completely derailed. All of his work disappeared because the world's focus was on this new Lake Tahoe outbreak and chronic fatigue syndrome. And I contacted Dr. Rill, and he told me exactly what was going to happen. Because as soon as you start to accumulate compelling evidence, irrefutable evidence, evidence that cannot be denied, the Center for Disease Control is going to say, well, it's inconclusive because we haven't tested it yet. So we will come up with a new name. And when they change the name, all the evidence that was solid, verifiable, and found in the original entity becomes speculative for the new name. It's a way to reset the clock, basically throw out the game, start all over at square one, because everything you knew in infectious venulitis becomes speculative for the new name. Sure enough, that is exactly what they did. Every time some new finding comes out that cannot be argued with, they simply come up with a new name, revert that finding to being speculative because it hasn't been tested in whatever the new doctors and new group they're looking at, and it's starting the game all over again. So that's why I resist changing the name chronic fatigue syndrome, because the moment you change it to something else, then it becomes based on whatever the new doctor's ideas are, and you throw away every piece of evidence from the original chronic fatigue syndrome outbreak.
That's what you have been seeing, correct?
Over and over, yes. And if a scientist is aware that they are displacing verifiable evidence by doing this, then one has to look carefully at their motives.
It definitely calls motives into question.
Yeah, what kind of scientist would throw out a really good, solid finding so they could start over again unless they had some kind of agenda? For example, in the original Tahoe outbreak, one of the findings noticed by Dr. Peterson was an extremely low erythrocyte sedimentation rate, SED rate. Now, in a blood test, a very old blood test, in fact, the first blood test ever invented was the SED rate, the sedimentation rate. You just take fresh whole blood and put it in a thin, narrow tube called a Westergren tube. and over an hour, the red cells will settle out of the plasma, leaving the plasma, clear plasma at the top. At the rate at which the red cells settle is called the erythrocyte sedimentation rate. And because it's such a crude test, this was actually the first finding for measuring how healthy blood is or isn't. An elevated sed rate, that is more clear plasma appearing at the top, is associated with inflammatory diseases. And in chronic fatigue syndrome patients, the red cells wouldn't settle at all, not even a little bit. You have a zero sed rate, which is essentially the opposite of inflammation. Well, this blood test was on standard blood panels for many, many years, but it's so crude and nonspecific that doctors really don't like to use it anymore. However, is it really of no value? A low, an artificially low sed rate, where the red cells don't settle at all, are only known in about 5 known diseases, all of them very serious, like polycythemia, hyperglobulinemia, sickle cell anemia, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. All of them serious, potentially fatal diseases. So if you see an abnormal blood reading, a doctor should be alarmed. And yet this was found consistently in the Lake Tahoe outbreak. When Dr. Cheney eventually left Lake Tahoe, this was his primary marker. When he found an unusually low sed rate in patients, he would do further investigation, and in each and every one of them, he said they were consistent with the Lake Tahoe illness. So when they create a new definition, and this was not entered into the official chronic definition at the time, this observation somehow magically disappears. It hasn't gone away. But by creating a new definition, they managed to forget about it.
You got all that?
I don't know. It's kind of crazy and complicated. But it's like, if you had a strangely low sed rate, you'd want that looked into.
Yeah, especially if I knew it was associated with other very serious illnesses. That would be a concern.
Yeah, and if a doctor knows this, if a doctor is aware of this unusual finding, how could they knowingly create a new definition that omits it? I mean, they would have to be aware that they are suppressing evidence from an earlier name.
Do you think they are aware, or has all this been lost in translation at this point?
Well, I've discussed this with researchers, and they seem like intelligent, normal people. How could they forget? How could they forget about this? It doesn't seem possible. Like in the Tahoe outbreak, since they were doing all these blood tests and the EBV serology test, one of them, or the primary one with the EBV finding, is that Epstein-Barr virus immortalizes cells. It immortalizes the B cells. The virus doesn't want the cell to die. It wants to proliferate and create more cells, viral infected cells, and spread itself. And it's very good at it. So the test is actually detecting the monoclonal expansion, or the clonal expansion of B cells, a proliferation of B cells. Well, we were seeing the exact opposite in the Lake Tahoe outbreak. Total loss of B cells, destruction of B cells. We found out what that was. Many in the Lake Tahoe outbreak were infected with the HBLV virus, a newly discovered virus that attacks the B cells and is so ferocious at wiping them out. It's called the cytopathic effect, the cell-killing effect. This virus is so efficient at wiping out B cells that the proliferation of B cells in the Epstein-Barr virus syndrome was negated. It was the opposite. So in the Lake Tahoe outbreak, the basis of chronic fatigue syndrome, we were seeing a complete loss of B cells. So for a researcher, if you know that you've got such a discrepancy, one syndrome has too many B cells, the next syndrome has no B cells, it's not something that you can really forget about. It's a confusing thing that you have to take into account. So in translation to the chronic fatigue syndrome, how did researchers manage to put this out of their mind?
Because maybe there was so much evidence already built on a different basis and not basis on ground zero.
I believe that researchers, essentially, they want to solve their own thing. They all want to pursue their own theory. Maybe they think they're honest by doing this. Maybe they think it's for the greater good. But when it winds up with them suppressing evidence, setting aside evidence they know is important and relevant and found in the original entity, I believe they're crossing the line at that point. They're not really practicing honest science, and they've broken the rules.
And that's why we're here. And that's the whole point of this podcast, Eric, because you have been trying to get ears and eyes and attention to this for over 30 years, since you've been a prototype for chronic fatigue, because you are probably, possibly the only live witness who has this experience from the inside out with the knowledge that you've obtained from being an original prototype of chronic fatigue syndrome. So you're really in a very unique position to be able to speak on this and point all this out.
Yeah, it's like I'm the only person who cares enough to say something.
It's actually kind of sad that we seem to be looking at a situation where you're ringing the alarm bells that this is, I mean, you've been telling people for years, if we don't do something about this, in 20 years, everyone's going to have a mold story because this is going to keep getting worse. And that's exactly what we've seen happen.
Yeah, I think this really needs to send a wake-up call to society that the medical profession is not practicing good, honest science. And if they're doing this to such a large, controversial entity as chronic fatigue syndrome, what else are they doing it to?
I think that's a really hard pill for the average person to swallow, because white coats are trusted and our research teams are trusted. And if you want to prove you're right, you pull up a peer-reviewed research article like it's the final answer on everything. So what happens when there's more going behind the scenes that hasn't been identified that's manipulating or interfering how research or which research is done? And I think in this way, we may be being abused by our medical system. And a lot of people have Stockholm syndrome with blind eyes and just identifying with their abuser.
Yeah, we want to trust our medical professionals. They seem honest and decent in so many ways. So to run into a situation where we see this lapse of scientific integrity, it's extremely alarming.
Almost unbelievable. But I believe you, Eric.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's why we're here and we're doing what we're doing and trying to spread information and provide people with the accurate information on what has been going on and what will continue to go on if we don't shake up the medical establishment and, push them, not tap lightly and ask anymore, but push them to make some changes, because I don't know how many people that reach out to me, that reach out to Keely, that reach out to Eric, that are desperate for answers. And the people that they thought that they can trust, they understand and they know. And like Keely said, they are being abused by these people. And they're being turned a cold shoulder. And it's just not right. So thank you, everyone, for listening today. Wow. I mean, every session that I have with Keely and Eric blows my mind. And you know what? The story is only going to continue to unravel. So stay tuned for more on this series. We're not sure where it's going to end. So we're still going on that wonderful, crazy ride of learning more about chronic fatigue syndrome at Ground Zero in Lake Tahoe. So again, stay tuned. Thank you to those who have donated and those who are continuous listeners. Please, please, please donate to our GoFundMe or our Patreon accounts, so we can continue providing you with the most up-to-date and accurate information on toxic mold to help you and your family's health. So thank you so much again, and have a wonderful day.